Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as we head toward a new year and a new decade, Naomi Klein is our first guest this hour on the 10th anniversary of her book, No Logo, the groundbreaking critique of brand-oriented capitalism that came out in 1999. A 10th anniversary edition is now out from Picador with a challenging new essay at the top called No Logo at 10, which is mostly what we'll talk about. She critiques President Obama and some of his voters, among many other things. Naomi Klein, congratulations on No Logo at 10, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
In this essay, you recall that you first got into journalism before No Logo, writing about the limited job options available to you and your peers just getting out of college. And it's so reminiscent of what the new generation of college grads is going through right now. Can you take us back and reflect on what was going on at that time, I guess the early 90s?
Yeah, early and mid-90s. I was actually a token youth columnist at the newspaper in my hometown of Toronto, the Toronto Star. And so, yeah, I was on the youth beat. And what that meant was covering the job market for young people, which was increasingly dismal. A lot of people with advanced degrees working in the service sector, working in temp jobs. But I was also covering the way in which youth culture was changing, because this was a period where there was a really accelerated corporatization of everything having to do with youth, from ideas. This was like Seattle grunge, and you know, it was sort of like everything it seemed that our sort of demographic group did was declared the next mega trend. It was, you couldn't sort of think of anything before it turned into an advertising campaign. We also were seeing the first advertisements on our campuses. We were seeing a very rapid corporatization and privatization of public education. The Channel One entering the high schools, and
that
at
was
my
the
university
time of Channel One. For people who don't remember, a newscast, I guess it was about a 15-minute newscast, to be played in schools as kind of a civics lesson, but it had commercials in it in the public schools.
Exactly. And then at the university level, we were seeing more and more of corporate logos turning up on the buildings and sponsored chairs, you know, the Kellogg's chair, this and that, and all kinds of scandals related to that about how it was affecting research. So I was covering all of this as a young journalist in my 20s, and I remember the moment when I decided to write No Logo, and it was that I read a piece written by Tom Peters in Fast Company magazine. You know, this was the 90s,
Tom,
right?
Peters, the corporate success branding guru.
Yes, and who writes almost exclusively in all caps with a lot of exclamation marks. And it was about branding and the revolution in branding. And it was a lecture to corporations who were still, in his view, mired in the world of stuff. They thought that they were actually selling things, lowly things, products like laptops and running shoes and cups of coffee. And they didn't understand that if they wanted to succeed, they had to be in the ideas business. They had to spend their money on marketing. And the way to do that, the way to free up capital, was to sell off your factories and not hire full-time employees, but pour your money into research and design and marketing. And I just had this click moment where I realized that these two big trends that I had been covering as a young journalist, the deterioration of the job market, the fact that we were only being offered these casual jobs on the one hand, and this aggressive marketing and corporatization of public space on the other hand, were actually the same story that these same companies had decided to divest from their workers and go into the ideas business. So that made them more voracious as marketers and much less reliable as employers.
And one classic example from your book, Nike as, rather than a shoemaker, as the idea of transcendence through sports, right?
But once you decide that you're about an idea as opposed to a product, then what you need most are canvases on which to express that idea. So that's why Nike really sort of took over the world of sports and became so aggressive in marketing and really transformed sports.
So is that era over? Is it getting worse? What?
Well, it's funny because It's of course, it always gets worse. You know, I have a quote in No Logo from a marketer saying consumers are like cockroaches. You spray them, they get immune after a while. So they're always, you know, marketing has to up the ante in order to get our attention. But when I thought about updating No Logo and writing this new essay, I really didn't want to just track how much worse the marketing has become, and you know how many more television shows are actually veiled marketing. That, you know, I think that's probably one of the biggest shifts from No Logo. I was tracking like sort of the first product placement in movies and things like that. But of course, you know, reality TV has become the ultimate canvas for the total integration of marketing and content. But I'll tell you, you know, I read about this a little bit in the introduction. One of the things that happened to me, because in writing No Logo, I had to completely immerse myself in the world of marketing for, you know, a good 5 years. And it was sort of fun because I could disguise shopping as research, right? You know, and this was
useful, nice trick.
Right?
And get paid for it.
Exactly. And going to really crummy Hollywood movies and say, I'm tracking the product placement here, right? But it got to me after a while, and I developed this. I really was so pleased when I finally finished the book that I didn't have to immerse myself in this culture. It was like eating too much junk food.
Naomi Klein, my guest on WNYC on the 10th anniversary edition of No Logo. We can take your phone calls for her, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, if you want to talk to Naomi Klein today. And you're right that you have actually turned down offers over the years, once No Logo became big, for synergistic spinoffs, feature films, TV series, clothing line. Did someone actually offer you a clothing line branded No Logo?
What was so weird about that guy is, the title No Logo and the cover of the book is very elegant. And it's designed actually by a really, you know, amazing designer named Bruce Mao. And we wanted the cover to be a culture jam. I have a chapter in the book on culture jamming, on the practice of parodying ads and making them send an anti-marketing message. So we wanted the cover, I wanted the title to be a culture jam. So that was the idea of creating an anti-logo logo. And it really looks like a great logo. The problem is it looked so good that people thought they could use it to sell all kinds of things. You know, I was walking down the street in Geneva once. I was doing a story on the UN. And I walked out by a restaurant and I look in the window and it's called No Logo. And it's the exact same logo. There's a line of olive oil.
But you purposely did not copyright the title.
Yeah, we made this decision.
The visual.
Yeah, my publisher actually wanted me to copyright. But, you know, I also have a chapter in the book about copyright and how we need to have less of it and all these artists getting sued for using corporate logos and making their art. So I did not want to copyright it. So everything that's happened is my own fault. I knew there was the risk. I made the decision. But then what happened is this guy started a line of No Logo clothing. He asked me whether I wanted to go into business with him. And I said, no, I didn't. I didn't want to go into the fashion business with him. And then I got a lawyer's letter from him telling me that I was violating his trademark because he had gone ahead and trademarked No Logo for his clothing company.
No, that is so low.
So we just ignored it.
And one funny line you write is that there was actually a career to be made in being a kind of anti-corporate dominatrix, making overpaid executives feel good by telling them what bad, bad brands they were.
Mm.
Can you take us a little bit into that? Seriously, what would a company want with an anti-corporate you?
Well, because this was part also of the phenomenon that I was writing about, of the absorption of anything alternative, anything youth-oriented, anything cutting edge. I mean, that's what was happening in the world of marketing. And I used to write for a magazine, a journal called The Baffler, which was a fantastic journal edited by Tom Frank, and they're actually starting publishing again. And they had a cover in this period called Commodify Your Dissent. This was the period where these brands were like sponges. They wanted to always co-opt the opposition. So when No Logo came out, I started to get these invitations to speak at corporations and, yeah, tell them what bad brands they were, and in the process that they would get ideas for their next advertising campaign. So I never did that. I had a really clear policy from the beginning that I was not going to become a corporate consultant, and there's nothing that I would say in private that I don't say in public, so I didn't see the point.
Naomi, put on your headphones because we'll take a phone call. Naomi Klein, my guest on WNYC on the 10th anniversary edition of her book, No Logo. And Tom in Rumson, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I was going to ask Ms. Klein, what does she think the ultimate end game or the end of capitalism this country is going to be if they're most concerned with selling things and not creating jobs or the type of jobs where people can afford to buy products, whether, you know, if their quality, especially, if she has any thoughts on that? Are we going to descend into, like, peonage, where we're just Walmart consumers and then a small elite that just can purchase high-grade goods?
Well, I think that's kind of been happening. We've been certainly been going in that direction. And one of the things that's most disturbing about this economic crisis and the way in which the government has responded to the financial crisis is that in many ways we're seeing the sort of final stage of the attack on the manufacturing sector in the United States. Bob Reich had a really good piece a couple of days ago saying that the reason stocks are back up on Wall Street is because unemployment is down, that companies have increased their share value in the same way that they did it in the 90s because by laying off workers, yeah. And it's the fastest way to make your earnings look better.
Because employment is down. Unemployment is down. Because unemployment is down.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly.
It's a redistribution of wealth in that respect.
But, you know, you asked about the end game, and, you know, I think maybe it's Mother Nature who's going to be doing that for us in the form of climate change and the total ecological unsustainability of the business model that we're talking about here, of buying goods at Walmart or wherever that have been produced on the other side of the planet and have been brought to us on emission-spewing freighters or jumbo jets. I mean, there is no more emissions-intensive way to run an economy than the one we have developed.
And in connection with that, you also look back in this essay to the movement that sprung up around the same time as you were writing No Logo, that has an environmental component that came to be labeled the anti-globalization movement. But you actually denounced the mainstream media for giving it that label. What was wrong with calling it the anti-globalization movement, which I think reflected a lot of the values that you talk about in No Logo?
Well, you know, in No Logo, the final section of the book is about the rise of what I called at the time anti-corporate activism that was actually using the global networks that had been forged by these super brands in order to show the underside of this production process, whether it was finding out about oil spills in Nigeria and connecting that to where you bought the gas for your car, or finding out about the sweatshops in which your clothing was being made and creating connections between workers. So to me, what was always so exciting about this movement was that it was global. And, you know, thinking back to the 90s, we've so rarely used the word capitalism. Globalization was really a synonym for capitalism, and all of these various things were bundled into the same single catchphrase: using the internet, crossing borders, travel, and also this set of policies of privatization and deregulation that was embedded in these trade deals that were being forged at places like the World Trade Organization and embedded in agreements like NAFTA. So the idea was, if you were against those trade deals, which is what we were against in Seattle and in many of the other protests, then you were against the world. You were against globalization. And I always rejected that phrase because it just wasn't true.
So has this international anti-corporate or anti-capitalist movement or anti-capitalist excess movement had an impact over the 10 years, in your opinion?
Well, it definitely has. The World Trade Organization hasn't really been able to get another meeting on track since Seattle. I mean, they had the Doha round, but it's been derailed for many years now. But the reason why I actually wanted to reissue No Logo 10 years later is because I feel like the timing for this movement is much better now than it was when the book came out. You know,
people are much angrier today than they were in 19. I mean, 1999. You know, there's a phrase now. There's a cliche. Do you know it? We're going to party like it's 1999.
Well, exactly. And we were the party crashers, right? We were in Seattle in 1999, boomtown Seattle, right? This was
internet bubble.
It was the height of the internet bubble. And I always remember the mainstream press had completely ignored the rise rise of this movement. So it had no idea what was coming in Seattle, because there was no, you know, I start No Logo with a quote from an Indonesian poet saying, you might not know it, but underneath it's already on fire. And that was really the feeling. So a couple of days before the shutdown in Seattle, before the huge protests in Seattle during the World Trade Organization summit, I pitched a story to the New York Times op-ed page. This is a really silly reminiscence, but I said, you know, there's going to be these huge protests. I've just written a book. At this point, No Logo was at the printer. I said, I've just written a book about this movement that you're about to see in Seattle. I'd like to write an op-ed explaining the roots of this movement and what its goals are. And I was told by the op-ed editor at the time that they didn't need an op-ed because they already had one about the WTO. And I said, oh, well, do you mind if I ask who wrote the op-ed? And they said, Bill Gates. And I was like, but I think I have a different perspective. And they're like, no, we don't need it. And then, you know, the next day, actually, Seattle was filled with tear gas. There were tens of thousands of protesters in the city. The talks were derailed. And I got a call back from the New York Times saying, do you have that op-ed? So I ended up getting the piece published.
Ahead of the times. The times ahead of the time. No, behind the time. I don't know. There's a cliche in there somewhere. Catherine in Larchmont, you're on WNYC with Naomi Klein. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I agree with Naomi about local sourcing. I think companies can do a much better job with that. I disagree in that I think corporations, I'm in marketing, and I think corporations have a very good place in helping people, you know, in different respects. Like I think of Nike with the Girl Project or Dove with its self-esteem project. And right now municipalities are really hurting, and I don't see what would be wrong for, you know, getting money in exchange for police and sanitation, you know, from a company. The way that we clean our highways now, where it's sponsored by someone, I mean, that's a very successful program.
And in fact, we just did a segment last hour, I don't know if either of you were listening, on Goldman Sachs giving a lot of money to LaGuardia Community College
exactly.
in Queens to help with retraining workers and starting new businesses.
But I think, Naomi, go ahead.
I'm all for getting corporations to help pay for universities and roads and healthcare. I just think it should be done through the tax system. And, you know, with the banks, it's even more ironic because a lot of these banks are only in business thanks to massive taxpayer bailouts. So then they turn around and rather than pay taxes at the level that they should pay taxes, they generously sponsor with their logo, you know, business schools and sports stadiums. But it's actually the taxpayers' own money. So not only is it not coming in the form of taxation, but it's a very, very circuitous route. I mean, the problem is that it often comes with strings attached. It's often in a very ad hoc manner. I mean, when I was researching new developments in branding for the introduction, I didn't include this in the introduction, but I found out of cases in some municipalities in the United States responding to precisely what the caller is talking about, where they have sponsored, KFC is sponsoring the filling of potholes. So there'll be a pothole and it will be paved over, but there will be the KFC logo on that. You know, this is a real crisis in the public sphere.
Do you want
and
that
I'm old
in
fashioned
downtown?
That way. I really think this should be paid for through taxation.
Catherine, are you ready to see KFC logos on the manhole covers downtown Larchmont?
Well, KFC logos are there for a little bit and then they actually wash away, so it's not a permanent thing.
So you're familiar with this?
Yeah, I am familiar with it. I think it was a brilliant
idea. Was it your idea?
Actually. Huh? No, but I wish I did think of it. I think that, you know, advertisers paid for newspapers. They paid for TV. Everybody got free, you know, news. Now that's changing because people are getting their news in different ways, and advertisers have to find different ways to reach consumers. We still do have an economy where people make things and we have to sell them and people have to buy them.
I'm really glad you brought up the newspaper example, and Catherine, thank you for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
Naomi, as a journalist, are you at all now nostalgic for robust advertising that supported investigative reporting and everything else in newspapers? You know, if you love to hate advertising for a long time, do you now look and say, oh my God, what's happening to journalism? We have to get the advertising back.
Well, look, to me, it was never about, writing about branding was never about writing about advertising. It was, in a sense, writing about the end of advertising, because what I was tracking in No Logo was the flip in the order of things, where before this explosion in the idea of lifestyle branding and companies producing ideas instead of products, you had the public infrastructure and you had journalism and you had the advertisements that were hitching a ride on that culture. What branding does is it flips the order, and the journalists become content providers for the advertisement, rather than the primary purpose of the newspaper, the media outlet being journalism and the advertisements, the ads sort of hitching a ride on that. And then you had the firewall between the ad department and the editorial department, which was often breached, and there would be scandals about that. But then you had really the erasing of that line and the total integration and journalism being turned into to content provider for the advertisements. So I am nostalgic for that age, for sure.
Naomi Klein with us for another few minutes on the 10th anniversary of her book, No Logo, 10th Anniversary Edition, just out, with a No Logo at 10 introductory essay. And a good portion of that essay is actually a bracing critique of President Obama and the way progressives have embraced him. For one thing, you call him the first U.S. president who is also a super brand. Do you mean that as an insult?
Well, it's, you know, what I always said about the super brands is that, the problem wasn't the image that they were projecting. It was the gap between the image and the reality. And that's what always made them vulnerable. You know, the caller talked about Nike and the good things that Nike's done. But the reason why Nike became vulnerable to the activists who were outing the practices in their sweatshops was because there was this gap. There was between exactly the types of marketing that she mentioned, like the girl empowerment projects, which are fantastic, right? And then finding out, wait a minute, there's 14-year-old girls making these running shoes in Indonesia. That doesn't add up. And you put one of those 14-year-old girls on camera and she's talking about needing a raise and being abused by her manager and you've got a branding problem, right? So I always thought that the brands provided a really important tool for activists in getting more accountability actually from the corporate sector. And ultimately the goal is to leverage that into standards, political regulations that are applied to the industry across the board rather than doing it brand by brand, which is hugely inefficient. But yeah, Obama, you know, the problem is not that he is an incredible brand manager, and he is. I mean, they used every modern tool of branding to win that campaign. And, you know, whether viral marketing, user-generated content like Obama Girl, incredible use of new technologies, the 30-minute infomercial, the incredible logo, real branding consistency, the message of hope, obviously. But that's not the problem. The problem is the gap between the messaging and the reality. And now they have a branding problem. They've got a lot of people who had their hopes raised, who projected. I mean, this is the way in which there was something very corporate about the way they managed the campaign, was that they did that thing that great brands do, which is create a canvas that sort of plays on sort of memories of movements. This is what Nike did so well in the 90s. This is what Apple did so well in the 90s, where you get like sort of snippets of a Martin Luther King speech or an image of Gandhi. But, you know, you don't go into it in too much depth. And so you're playing on people's memories of a more idealistic time. And you don't come right out and say that this is what you stand for and this is what you're going to do. But you say enough to create an opportunity for people to project onto you and think they know what you mean. And that's what the Obama campaign did about a lot of things. And now we're seeing in office that they are also, in a way, acting like marketers in that they want to please as many people as possible all the time. There's an aversion to taking the hard decisions that will actually, get some enemies. And yeah.
And you come right out and say he's failing, at least in your opinion, to live up to his brand. But to be in New York and watch the media coverage, the Obama administration trying to bring 9/11 attackers to justice in criminal court, inflaming a lot of other people this past week, trying to get an ambitious, if imperfect, health care bill through Congress. He's revised the goal, at least, of a nuclear-free world, and I could list other things. How critical are you?
I'm critical, and I think people should be critical, because I think the more critical people are of Obama, the better a president he will be. I've I think that the real problem is not with Obama. It's actually with Obama's base, which is actually much more like consumers than it is like a political movement. You know, despite the claim that this was, a political movement that brought Obama to power, unfortunately, there's still this consumerist idea, you know, we voted, now we can relax. That's not how political change has ever come in this country. It's certainly not how political change came during the last major economic crisis, during the Great Depression. You had an incredibly mobilized population that continued to put massive pressure on FDR and that famous phrase, you know, make me do it. And that dynamic that he had with social movements, where he needed the social movements, he needed the labor movement to be much more radical than he was so that he could sell the New Deal as a compromise to the elites, because the alternative looked like socialism, really looked like socialism. You know, one of the lessons I think of just the devolution of some public discourse in this country represented by people like Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin is that even the most modest measures are getting Obama described as a socialist, fascist, maybe even Hitler, right? They haven't left themselves anywhere to go, as far as I can tell. Like, once you compare the president to Hitler, like, where do you go after that? So to me, the lesson is he may as well do some serious reform, you know, instead of these half measures that he seems to favor so much, because the criticism can't get much worse.
Before you go, and we're just about out of time, do you think a lot of this looks different to you because you're Canadian, with health care, for example, living under the Canadian single-payer health care system, or does it just look to you the way it looks because you are who you are?
Well, you know, I am who I am in the sense that I'm American and Canadian. Both my parents are American, and I was born in Canada. So I've always had I literally have dual citizenship. Uh-huh. But, you know, Canada has a tradition of satire, of strong satire. You know, a lot of the Saturday Night Live cast and Lorne Michaels from Canada, but also Marshall McLuhan is from Canada. You know, we in Canada,
and I thought they were all so nice,
are on the opposite side of this one-way mirror. I call it the largest one-way mirror in the world, where we can see you in the States, but you can't see us. So I do think it helps to be in Canada sometimes as an observer of American culture. There's a certain freedom in it because we aren't seen, but yet we see.
Naomi Klein, her book, No Logo, now out in a 10th anniversary edition with a No Logo at 10 essay at the beginning. Thank you so much. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's really fun.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up in just a minute, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers now legally liable for some of the flooding after Hurricane Katrina. Stay with us.